Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by Dr. Linda McCauley, a national leader on green initiatives in healthcare. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about a program in Kenya to help the 95% of the population not covered by health insurance. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Mark Maselli.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea should bring some comfort to the many hardworking parents out there who are struggling to put healthy meals on the dinner table each night.
We can all agree that in the wealthiest nation on earth, all children should have the basic nutrition they need to learn and grow and to pursue their dreams. Because in the end, nothing is more important than the health and well-being of our children. Nothing.
The Healthy, Hunger-Free Kids Act was signed into law last year with bipartisan support by President Obama and championed by First Lady Michelle Obama as part of her campaign to fight childhood obesity. The reauthorized law targets low-income students in an effort to narrow the nutrition gap by ensuring that all kids receive high-quality, healthy meals in schools. This goes for dinner as well. This new program will give children in need access to both a healthy dinner and to after-school academic and enrichment programs that can open doors for all students. The new dinner program already exists in about a dozen states, and the new law extends federal reimbursement to states for this new school supper program, addressing childhood obesity and childhood hunger at the same time to make sure that all children have a chance at a promising future. Now that's a bright idea. Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Linda McCauley, a national leader on green initiatives in healthcare. Dr. McCauley is also dean of the Nell Hodgson Woodruff School of Nursing at Emory University in Atlanta. Welcome, Dr. McCauley.
Thank you.
You know, you're at an interesting intersection of two popular industries, healthcare and green technology. And as we all know, creating safer and healthier environments through green initiatives has become a priority for many sectors of our society in recent years. And yet the public may not be aware that healthcare sector is an important part of this movement. Can you start out by telling us how healthcare is leading some of these green initiatives and what's significant about that?
Well, it's very significant because many people in healthcare believe that our profession and groups of profession should set the best model, the best practices, which in fact we weren't doing. As people began to look at where our waste and contamination and pollution were occurring, it was healthcare was one of the major problems environmentally. And so it's just very important, I think, philosophically to really walk the walk. And if you're really talking about helping make populations more healthy, then our care environments need to be the healthiest of the healthy. And so when you look at the statistics on the waste production of healthcare facilities, they were astronomical numbers. And our incinerators, what we were burning, and the amount of energy that we used to run our physical plants. And so it's time that we push healthcare forward as the best models.
So, Dr. McCauley, you're both a renowned environmental health researcher and a distinguished nurse leader of one of the most recognized university schools of nursing in America. And I think it's safe to say the profession of nursing has actually been quite prominent on environmental issues, and particularly as they relate not just to healthcare institutions, but as they relate to consumers with ANA taking a strong stand on issues like reducing exposure to PVCs and kids' lunchboxes and other places, and the emphasis on reducing consumer exposure to environmental toxins. So we'd be curious to know a little bit about how these two worlds came together for you personally, and maybe a little bit about what other initiatives are nurses leading in the area of environmental health.
You know, that's a good question. I started out as a pediatric nurse specialist and was interested in the health of children, and particularly I was interested in children who have undergone chemotherapy and the effects on their health. And you learn when you're a graduate student that the best way to get out of your program is to do what your professors think you should do instead of always what you want to do. And I remember one of my professors telling me that that she wasn't particularly interested in doing cancer research around children, but had I ever thought about nurses that handle anti-neoplastic drugs in their work practices, and are they exposed to these chemicals in their work, and do they have health effects? And it was just a different, a light just came on to me that, of course, that's important also. You shouldn't get sick from the environment in which you work in. And then if you study nursing and you look at Florence Nightingale, so from the deepest in our roots, she really was an environmentalist. During the Crimean War, she pointed out that most of the soldiers in the hospitals were not dying from the casualties, the wounds, or the trauma that they received on the battlefield, but from infections that they caught in the hospital environment. And so we listened to her, we shelved her ideas for 100 years, and now we realize that she really was so far ahead of her time and that she's exactly right. And the fact that she was one of the founders of nursing is really demonstrates the importance of this field to nursing. So I remember when I was at the University of Pennsylvania, I helped the Florence Nightingale Chair of Nursing, and I was so proud to do that because I felt it really did reflect my carrying on a tradition that started years ago. And what happened, nurses always felt that in the environment was important, but they started focusing on, well, after we send patients home from the hospital, what type of home environment do they go to? Is it going to promote their health? But they didn't focus on what was happening in the hospital and how healthy our hospital environment was. So we really, I think, are enlightened now, gone back to our roots and really understanding what is important. And the role of a healing environment, whether it's in the hospital or whether it's after a person goes home, or it's the environment that they live and breathe and work in every day. Speaking, so it just makes perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about the environment, I want to sort of pull together a couple of threads here. You're both a professor and you're the dean at the Emory University, Nell Hodgson's Woodruff School of Nursing. There's a group called Healthcare Without Harm, and I think it draws its roots from the Hippocratic Oath of first do no harm. And, they're focused in on promoting the health of people and the environment. And I was wondering if you thought about this, and not particularly this group, but that philosophy. Tell us how you're trying to integrate this philosophy into the next generation of healthcare providers, and what are you doing around curriculum development and the like?
I've been in nursing education for more than 30 years now, and it's never been easier to do this integration. It was very difficult in the 1980s. It became easier in the 1990s, and now it's very, very easy because young people, I think in their elementary and high school education, are really introduced to concepts of environmental sustainability.
So, Dr. McCauley, if I kind of want to pull that thread a little bit and go back to sort of the focus of our show is innovation and health reform and health policy. And of course, we can't help but talk a lot about controlling costs, eliminating waste, protecting patient safety and quality. And sort of in that vein, Dr. Peter Pronovost at Johns Hopkins, who we've had on the show, I noted was referenced in a release from Johns Hopkins in which the authors talked about the tremendous contribution to waste and thus to pollution that hospitals create. And he noted that we have gone so much to a culture of disposables, of throwing everything away, including tools and instruments, rather than re-sterilizing and reusing. And that, in fact, the evidence, which he obviously is a expert in around infection control, based on his work in saving lives from acquired infections, shows that you could safely do this, but that we have a huge public relations and marketing problem on our hands because we've made people so frightened about contracting infections in the hospital that the standard of care has become throw everything away. What's your thoughts on this, and how does this factor into the equations around cost, waste, quality, and evidence-based practice when it comes to decision-making that affects the environment?
So it's a very careful balance that you need to make. When you reuse something, yes, you certainly have to be absolutely 100% sure that you're able to clean that effectively. And you do use power and energy to re-sterilize things. And there's some things that actually the probably should be disposable, but there are other things that are just as energy efficient to sterilize those products. And so it's really what I've been working on is trying to bring the healthcare provider closer to the supply chain. For instance, they can get a disposable package, a kit for some type of procedure that's being done, and you open that blue plastic wrapping, and there may be 10 different instruments in that package, and the health provider will use two of those instruments and throw the other eight away. So that's a basic problem. Why is it only being produced? Why is the packaging in such a way that you can't just use the disposable items that you really need? And I don't think most consumers know that you can open a package and only use a quarter of what's in that package, and the rest you toss away. And so nurses and physicians don't think about, well, who orders this type of package? And many times it's not a health provider that orders that package. One of the things that has received a lot of attention are plastic phthalates that are in IV tubing. And so plastic tubing is a concern in terms of disposal and incineration, but there's no one arguing that there's any better way to deliver a fluid to a baby or an adult with an IV or a blood transfusion. But what we realized is that there are some plastics that leach out into the fluid that you're running through the tubing, and there's other plastics that don't have phthalates in them that don't leach out.
Dr. McCauley, as I'm remembering from my brief stint in Atlanta, Georgia, of several months, you're right down the road from the Centers for Disease Control. Is that right?
Yes, right. I'm looking out at the CDC right now.
Perfect. So that's a great image to think of relative to your work as the dean and nurse leader and environmental leader about cross-disciplinary interventions and study to understand the impact of environmental issues on the community. So maybe thinking less about healthcare and a little more just about the community, can you share with us some of the projects that your students or faculty or your cross-disciplinary teams are involved in your area relative to improving the environment or promoting environmental health or consumer awareness of environmental issues?
Well, there are many different levels in which one can do work in Atlanta right now. Many of my colleagues are focused on air pollution and the link with asthma and cardiovascular disease, because like so many urban cities, we have to deal with huge amounts of pollution from coal-burning plants and also from transportation. And so as Atlanta is, you know, planning whether to invest in mass transit or whether you want to rebuild the roads and put more cars on them, environmentalists have to step up to the plate and really explain why, given the choice, where you would make the wiser investment. My own work, what I'm passionate about, is the fact that so much about environmental health is not under the control of the individual. There are many things we can do in terms of the diets that we choose to eat and the cars that we drive and how far we want to commute, but there are many people who have no control over where they live and many times what food's available to eat. Climate change that may be occurring is many times outside of the control of the individual. And so what I love about Emory and being close to CDC is that we do stress vulnerable populations and people who have to depend on public policy to protect them to whatever extent is possible, whether that is the use of pesticides in where they live or traffic patterns around their homes or the scarcity of grocery stores, any healthy grocery store, much less accessibility to organic foods, which are a more healthy choice. So that's Emory University has been a wonderful environment with our proximity to CDC to really be able to focus on some of these larger issues.
Sure, and one of the things that Emory does very well is its sustainability program, which has a strong focus on sustainable foods. This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Linda McCauley, a national leader on green initiatives in healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, at our health center, we're building a new building, mm-hmm. hopefully LEED Gold. We're hoping. And we have a rooftop garden, and so we're engaged in trying to have young children plant food and sell it in our farmers markets. But Emory University is a big champion of educational food gardens. And in addition, Emory focuses on the importance of farmers markets. How does food offer additional opportunities for green, whether through community gardens, supporting farmers markets, or having hospitals serve healthier foods? Are there any special success stories you'd like to share with us?
One of the things, well, we do have wonderful gardens throughout Emory. In fact, we have a garden right coming into my back door here. But to give you an example of something that's in action, each of the schools at Emory with the economic recession were kind of charged with ways to look at our budgets and economic picture and way to generate new income. And a component of Emory, which is Oxford College, which is actually a section of Emory that's 30 miles outside of the city, had been given a gift by a generous donor of some acreage, and they have decided to make a $250,000 investment into sustainable gardens. And so the students on campus will be fed from those gardens, but what they're also doing is they're developing educational programs so that people can come to that campus and learn about sustainable gardening. And I thought, what a wonderful opportunity that you steward a wonderful gift from a donor, you bring healthy food to the students on campus, and you blend that with the educational mission of the university by teaching students and people in the community how to do this work in their own neighborhoods.
That's great.
That's what a university environment can do. And so That's when you really see that it's real, when it's more than just a building, when it's integrated into the campus life of the student and the educational mission of the university.
Today we've been speaking with Dr. Linda McCauley, a national leader on green initiatives in healthcare. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. Samuel Agutu is trying to bridge the gap between people having money in his native Kenya and falling ill. Since 2009, he's been testing out one solution to help some of the roughly 95% of Kenyans who are not covered by health insurance.
In the absence of a formal insurance plan, the idea was then to create a mechanism for medical prepayment or medical savings to enable people to save when they have the money.
Specifically, he wants to target women and their maternal health. The maternal mortality ratio in Kenya is among the highest in the world, and the East African nation is one of the world's worst performers in infant mortality, due in large part to unskilled deliveries. Agutu's electronic smart card, known as Chagamka, Swahili for cheer up, presents to Kenyan women an opportunity to save for a safe hospital delivery. Charging up the card with money, no matter how little, gives the women the discipline and mechanism to do so. The concept of health insurance is spreading through the developing world. Donika Dymowska, Senior Program Officer at the Results for Development Institute, explains that health insurance in developing countries has mainly existed in the form of community health insurance, which can have some drawbacks.
Sometimes a few communities or a few villages tend to work together to pool funding and risk to pay for health. So families gain access to a pooled fund through their church or community organization, and that's how they're able to cover some of their healthcare costs. But even that is very risky because if, for example, a national disaster strikes, like a drought or an earthquake, that type of funding would not be enough to support them.
So the concept of health insurance for women can certainly be seen as a giant leap forward and simultaneously as a form of empowerment. Agutu says that's exactly what he wanted to do with the Chagamka card.
The actual economic power rests with the husband, even if the income is earned by the woman. And so you find that there are many situations when women have been saving, but somehow the husband takes the money. And so by the time, when it's time for her to go for her hospital delivery, she doesn't have the money and therefore has to go for a traditional birth attendant or some other unskilled intervention.
Since the card was introduced, hospitals in Kenya have seen an increase of at least 30% of women regularly coming to the clinics for maternal care and delivery. As word spreads, in Kenya and across East Africa, the hope is that that number will keep climbing.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.